May 22, 2012. 28-year-old aid worker Helen Johnstone was riding a mule across the rugged, rocky terrain of Badakhshan. Helen is a British nutritionist and a recent graduate from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. With her was 26-year-old Kenyan health worker Morgarwe Oriere, along with two local guides. Both women work for MedAir, an international humanitarian aid organization. They were in the region to provide urgently needed medical help to the local population.
Badakhshan is an extremely poor region with an extremely high child mortality rate. Huge levels of sort of ignorance in healthcare, childcare, very poorly educated. Famine happens. There are major problems getting food in during the winter. If you're going to work there, you really have to have an understanding of what you're getting yourself into.
As the small group traversed along the valley, the towering Hindu Kush mountains cast long shadows across the path in front of them. It was quiet and desolate. Badakhshan has been considered relatively safe. The Taliban weren't active in the area. Attacks on visitors were rare. Helen and her colleagues were sure they would be fine.
Helen Johnson stated before she went in a newspaper interview, is that that was what she wanted to do. She wanted to go out there. She wanted to teach mothers, young mothers, how to look after their children properly, how to cope when a child has a bout of diarrhea, how they can give them sort of medical aid to help their children through that.
But Afghanistan can be a dangerous and unpredictable country. As Helen and Morgarwe headed up into the mountains, they didn't realize they were being watched.
So the one thing, when you're a Westerner operating on your own, unilaterally, in a place like Afghanistan, is that you become a target simply because of the perception that you may have money, and a lot of money, when you make a comparison with what the average salary is. And if you think about it, if you've got $400 or $500 in cash, you know, that's 5 or 6 years' salary in some parts of Afghanistan.
The two women looked up to see movement ahead of them. To their horror, men wielding machine guns were clambering down the mountains toward them. Within minutes, the young women were surrounded. The mysterious gang stole the women's cameras, mobile phones, laptops, and wallets. At this stage, the four women had no idea who was attacking them or what would become of them next. Bandits? Taliban? Or even Al-Qaeda? In any case, it was the beginning of a terrifying ordeal. Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations.
Their MO, the method of operation, only comes about by if you, the Westerner, you, the aid worker, you, the military guy, sets a routine, sets a pattern. That's breaking rule one of working in any theatre or any environment such as Afghanistan. You set a pattern and they've got you.
I'm Jamie Rennell. And I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special forces missions to learn about the brave soldiers and operatives who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives.
There's no handbook that you can pull down and says, oh, how to rescue a hostage. That's how we do it.
This is Operation Jubilee, Part 1. Within a few days, the mystery kidnappers make contact with the Afghan government. They then release a video of demands. Sean Raymond is a war journalist and author who has written extensively about military operations in Afghanistan.
I think $11 million they asked for. Well, you know, what are they going to do with $11 million in Afghanistan? You know, you're immediately going to be identifiable. But so they plucked this figure out of the air. We want $11 million and we want some of our colleagues who have banged up in prison in Kabul. We want those guys released. So that's their negotiating position. Otherwise, we will kill the hostages. So from their point of view, you know, that's a very strong position. We're hidden away in Badakhshan. There are no security forces anywhere near us. We're tucked away in a valley. No one's ever going to find us.
The video did reveal something good, however. The kidnappers weren't politically motivated. They're not Al-Qaeda or Taliban. They're just bandits out to further their own interests.
They wanted to get money, yes, but they also wanted to get members of their own group out of prison. They must have had an avenue for negotiation. So he must have worked all that out because it happened quite quickly. The chances are, I think, it probably, they didn't just come across her. She was targeted because things then happened very, very quickly.
The gang were a mixture of local drug runners and criminals, led by a known marauder, Abdul Ahad Mujahir. Frank Ledwidge is a former military officer who served in the Balkans, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
In a society which is as poor as Badakhshan, young men often gravitate towards and have to gravitate in order to make a living, particularly if their younger sons or perhaps don't have access, not married, aren't rooted. They will often gravitate to the money that warlords can provide. These are young men with weapons and young men who have dreams and aspirations of any other young man that need to be expressed through money. The only source of money, in the absence of any real economy, is, or any real legitimate economy, is the illegitimate economy, and that's dominated by warlords and groups and gangs such as Mujahirs. And there are many of them. That's how the Taliban recruit in the south. That's how the other warlord and insurgent gangs recruit in the rest of the country. There's a huge constituency of poor, disenfranchised young men.
Sir Robert Fox is a defense correspondent for the London Evening Standard newspaper.
For sure, the gangs don't go around with a specific label. They are coalitions. They are coalitions of interest. And they are very often just brigands and bandits who are there for human flesh. They're there to trade in human flesh because it's more valuable than stealing sheep, which are probably knackered and very difficult to handle anyway. And probably you're going to get a big money reward or a big power payback for this.
4 days after the demands are released, the news of the kidnapping finally reached the British government. Sean Raymond explained the government had to establish a few things before they could decide what to do.
First, you're going to establish, is it true? So they want to know, A, they've got her, and B, is she still alive? So you want to know what their negotiating position is. Now, because it's Afghanistan, that suddenly has international issues. It is one person, but it has international issues because Afghanistan, this is 2012, we're meant to be pulling out in a couple of years, but an aid worker has gone missing. This is pretty much world news. So that's your picture you're looking at. So there needs to be some response. So the government's sort of immediate action team, known as the COBRA team, Cabinet Office Briefing Room A, sits and they hold a meeting. That's for every national emergency. And so this is a national emergency by definition. And the Prime Minister will brief the COBRA committee, which will be made up of the National Security Advisor, the head of the armed forces, the director of special forces, MI5, MI6, and various cabinet members, briefing them on the situation. Over in Afghanistan, you have a process. Even though no order has been given, we've got to get this person back.
The British had a limited number of options. One, they could pay the money, but Britain doesn't negotiate with terrorists. Two, they could hope the situation can be resolved by the Afghan authorities, but this was unlikely. Or three, they could send in the troops. Ultimately, they went for the last option. Hey folks, I want to take a second to let you know about Bespoke Post. When you're really busy, when you're grinding away at the office or you're hanging out with friends, there's not a whole lot of time to think about upgrading your style or your apartment, which is why I love getting a new box of awesome from Bespoke Post every month. These folks are out there scouting for quality and unique products to send in each box. And now you can have some of that too at boxofawesome.com. Recently, I got the Weekender and the Forge. Those were my two last boxes, and they're awesome. One is a Damascus steel knife, which is just this really cool hunting knife, beautiful craftsmanship. And the Weekender is this really nice canvas bag, solid, sturdy construction, very stylish, looks a whole lot better than dragging around a roller suitcase. What I want you guys to do is go ahead and get started by visiting boxofawesome.com. Just answer a few short questions. That'll kind of help them get a feel for your style and the boxes that they think you'll like the best. Each box goes for under $50, but has more than $70 worth of unique gear waiting inside for you. You have 5 days to change colors and sizes or add extra stuff to your box. If you're not feeling that month's box, then you simply skip it. Right now, all of my listeners receive 20% off your first subscription box. So go to boxofawesome.com and enter the code COVERT at checkout. Make sure you enter COVERT. That's boxofawesome.com, code COVERT, for 20% off your first box. Bespoke post. Themed boxes for guys that give a damn. It had been 5 days since the aid workers were taken captive. The operation was passed on to the International Security Assistance Force. ISAF is a coalition of military personnel representing various countries that are part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. 29 countries make up NATO and the tangent ISAF, and they oversee all military operations in Afghanistan. Among ISAF leaders, rescuing the hostages became a priority mission. This was especially true among Britain and the United States.
British and American Special Forces have got a long relationship. It's probably closer now at the moment, given the 9/11 wars, but it has been for any other time in the last 50 years. They've done numerous operations together. You had Task Force Black, in which the SAS, SBS, all the various elements of the Special Forces were working hand in glove with the Americans, with Delta Force, SEAL Team 6, and the vast array of different American Special Forces groups. So they have an understanding of how things work. They both do specialise in hostage rescue operations. So they both use the same equipment, they both use the same helicopters, they both probably use the same techniques. They train together all the time. The fact that it was SEAL Team 6 and the SAS would have primarily, I think, just been because they were available. If it had come at a time when there was a huge SAS operation, then maybe the SAS wouldn't have been involved. From the Americans' point of view, if you're going in to rescue someone who's British and the British have got their own complement of highly trained special forces and you need them to be part of the operation anyway, why not give that element to the British? You know, if I was planning the operation or you were planning the operation, you'd probably think, yes, let them do that. If it goes wrong, then they can take the flak. But also, I think from the PR point of view, you know, you want British troops rescuing British personnel. So you've got the head of ISAF, Commander ISAF, who's an American at the time, General John Allen. You've got Adrian Bradshaw, ex-SAS, who's the deputy commander of ISAF. And he's probably saying, you know what, if it hadn't already been agreed, let the SAS get her out. You know, it's good for everybody. It's good for the country. It's good for the operation. You know, we're not talking about inexperienced operators here. We're talking about an organisation that's probably one of the best special forces units in the world.
Don Mann is a former Navy SEAL Team 6 commando with insight into the pre-planning that goes into such a sensitive mission.
Our operations centers, tactical operations centers, have a board of hostages in the country, known terrorists, terrorists on the hit list, and the SEALs will come in, the operating units will come in, and they look at this every day. They memorize what these hostages look like. They know what the terrorists look like. And they're waiting for the green light to get one of these missions. Once they get the mission to go after a hostage, what is that person's age? What is that person's physical condition? Where was that person last seen? What are the enemy forces surrounding that person? How many people took that person in captivity? Where is that location? How is our best way to get from where we are now to that location? Is it by helicopter? Is it fast roping? Is it rappelling? Is it skydiving? How do we get to the target? How many people will it take us to get there? And can we expect enemy resistance? All these factors go through the shooter's mind and the planner's mind in planning a hostage rescue.
At the back of all of their minds was the fact that hostage extractions are notoriously difficult. Britain knows this all too well. Britain was haunted by a tragedy that happened 2 years earlier, the death of yet another British aid worker, Linda Norgrove. Norgrove was snatched by the Taliban in almost identical circumstances. Fearing for her life, the British authorized a rescue mission conducted by U.S. Special Forces. But it went terribly wrong.
Usually we throw a flashbang or a flash crash. It's a diversionary device and sends up smoke and a loud noise and distracts a terrorist. And all the people going into the door are aware of the smoke and the noise, so they're not distracted. And while everybody else is shocked in the room, they scan, shoot the threats, and leave the non-threats alone. In this case, when the fragmentation was thrown, it wasn't realized that Linda was there nearby on the ground. And it was a terrible, terrible accident. I can absolutely understand how it would have happened. I mean, it was actually, you know, just something that could happen, and it's part of war, unfortunately. It's just part of war. Well, the incident with Linda was very, very unfortunate, very sad. First time it's happened in our history in SEAL teams.
The six Taliban holding Linda Norgrove were killed, but so was she. She died from shrapnel wounds inflicted by a fragmentation grenade. In Kabul, American General John Allen and UK Deputy Commander Bradshaw started putting together an operational plan. Once again, Frank Ledwidge, author of Losing Small Wars.
Any military operation nowadays is defined by what's called the three Fs. Find, that's location. Fixing, making sure that the people in that location are there when you get there. And finish, which is the conduct of the operation itself. And often meaning, of course, kill. Those are the three Fs. And that's what the Special Forces team will be doing from the start of this. They'll be finding our hostages, they'll be ensuring they're not moved, and that the area in which they're held is that the soldiers are as aware as they possibly can be of every aspect of the environment in which the hostages are held. That can mean get down to details such as what are the walls made of if it's a house? How deep are the caves? What material are the caves made from? You know, it's relevant, of course, to ricochets and things like that. How many entrances there are and so on. Every question you can possibly imagine will be dealt with in the find and fix phase of the mission. And then, of course, is execution.
Initially, the mission planners focus on the first F, finding the gang. Nigel Spud Eli is a former SAS soldier and war photojournalist.
Well, of course, you need the location of where they're being held. You need strength of the enemy. What their daily routine is, you need. And you need luck. You need to know the type of weapons. You need to know why they've taken this person hostage, although most of the time you don't.
Finding the rough location of the hostages proved fairly straightforward. Kidnappers had been careless with their cell phone use, and their inexperience was a much-needed lucky break. By using their mobiles in negotiations, the kidnappers had given themselves away.
There's nothing magic about mobile phone intercepts. Basically, it's important to remember, I think, that mobile phones are nothing more than little radios. And we've been conducting radio direction finding since the First World War. That's how U-boats were found in the Atlantic. Second World War was honed down even further, and since then it's come down to literally to a fine art where you can locate where somebody is. As everyone knows who has a mobile phone, everybody's fully aware that if the mobile phone company, or for that matter the law enforcement authorities, want to find out where you are, it's very easy to do so in this country. Now in Afghanistan there's very little in the way of 3G, let alone 4G, you know. However, everybody has a mobile phone and everybody uses them. Now, in order to establish the location of your hostage taker, you need to establish who that hostage taker is and what his phone number is. Once you've done that, it's not the most complex thing in the world at all to track him through that.
British intelligence intercepted the kidnapper's calls. And using a combination of GPS and cell network triangulation, they easily established a rough location. They deduced the kidnappers were somewhere within a deep cave complex in the vast Koilaram forest in northwest Badakhshan. Immediately, they realized this presented a complication. Even if they are able to find the kidnappers, narrow, cramped caves can be very difficult to assault.
Navigating using GPS, map, or compass, and they're heading to the cave on the point man's direction. It's all hand and arm signals, radio traffic, and it's very quiet, very stealthy. They take the most direct route, or the path of least resistance. Once they get up to the cave, they already know if they have the element of surprise on their side. They can, if they still have that element of surprise, be on the outside. As soon as they know the last man on the assault team is ready, they send the signal up, boom. If they had enough time, they even know how far they're going into the cave, who's going left, who's going right, how deep the cave goes. We have known floor plans and unknown floor plans. For a cave, you could pretty much assume it was an unknown floor plan, not knowing how deep that was going to go.
The rescuers needed to pinpoint the exact location of the kidnappers to within a few hundred feet, so they launched their unmanned aerial vehicles, drones.
Once you've found the leader of the group or one of his gang, it's fairly straightforward then to build up through, possibly again through human intelligence, who are their friends, who are their associates, where do they go, where are they from, who are their family, who they've been associated with in the past. So you can build up a network that way. And certainly our intelligence people will have done that very quickly. But you can also do it through mobile phones, obviously, through an analysis of the calls that they make and the calls that are made by the people to whom they make calls. But it's important to understand that this is part of a big tapestry of human intelligence, signals intelligence, and image intelligence.
Flown remotely by operators in California, these spies in the sky would likely be able to spot the kidnappers without being detected. The MQ-1 Predator uses infrared cameras with digitally enhanced zoom lenses. It can identify the heat signature of a human body from over a mile altitude.
20,000 feet above it, you won't see it, you won't hear it, but that can give you 24 hours, 22 hours a day, I think it can stay up for, live video footage of what's going on the ground. It's May, the weather's good. It's got fantastic optics, so daylight becomes... it's as good as nighttime. They can see everything. They can see what weapons they've got, what guards they've got. They can see the approaches. They can see the routine of the guards. They can see where the people are being split up. So that's the situation. So very short period of time, they know precisely who they're dealing with, what their weapons are, what the threat they pose is, and where they're located. And the special forces know at some stage they're going to be called into operation, because unless the kidnappers decide, actually, we've made a mistake here, we're going to give them up, because we don't negotiate with kidnappers or terrorists, there's going to be an operation. So that's the situation where you are.
A drone can get in there, get across over the mountain pass, come back with the information our troops need to conduct an op. Drones are beautiful.
Thanks to the undetected drone, the exact location of the hostages was pinpointed. From then on, the kidnappers were kept under 24-hour surveillance. Intel showed that the gang were well-armed with AK-47 assault rifles, rocket-propelled grenades, and a Russian belt-fed machine gun. Reportedly, this weapon was capable of shooting down helicopters. Over the next few days, the Joint Task Force watched the kidnappers' activities on real-time video transmitted via satellite from the drone. They then used this information to plan the details of the rescue. Unaware they were being watched, the kidnappers continued negotiations. This was all part of the ISAF plan.
It is essential to negotiate. It is essential to get the go-betweens talking. Because by getting the go-betweens talking, you begin to profile the principals in the principal players in the kidnapped party or the receivers or the people who are going to lead you into the place where the kidnapped are being held.
They would have been sold a line that, yes, we're negotiating. Yes, we will give you everything you want. Yes, we will release the guy from prison. Yes, we will give you your $11 million. It's coming in a black suitcase. What denomination do you want? Give us a bit more time. We can get it in this. Would you like something else to go with it? You know, playing for time, you know, giving them this false sense of security, trying to develop some sort of rapport with them so that they feel comfortable.
From their extensive military resources, ISAF commanders generals John Allen and Adrian Bradshaw selected who would actually be going on the mission.
There is great mutual respect. It would be expected, almost as a matter of etiquette and protocol, that the Brits would be asked if they could lead this, what help do they need, and they would work it from there. Then actually they do become genuine coalition efforts.
If Britain was taking the lead, this could only mean one thing. it would be a job for the world-famous SAS. The Special Air Service is the elite Special Forces and Counterterrorism Unit of the British Army. Their roster of successful missions includes a rescue of soldiers in Sierra Leone and taking back a hijacked plane in Somalia. The SAS often operates in superbly trained four-man units, and it prides itself on its ability to fight unsupported anywhere in the world. Experts in stealth and surprise, their surveillance skills help them monitor, infiltrate, and execute targets with deadly efficiency. The SAS were deployed to Afghanistan in 2001 and had been heavily active in countless covert missions ever since. They are widely regarded as the best of their kind and the model for countless special forces across the world. This includes teaching and training other forces in the techniques that have made the regiment famous, CQB.
It's a different type of warfare. It's CQB, close quarter battle. It requires an intense type of training, live ammunition, live training in small confined rooms. And you have to be extremely careful as live rounds are flying all over the place. It's very intense. And not everyone can do it. Not everyone can be at that height of intensity for such a long time.
But the SAS aren't the only elite force in Afghanistan on hand to rescue Helen and Morgarwe. The United States also has an impressive range of special force units, but one stands out.
You know, some people say SEAL Team 6 are the best of the best, the best of the SEALs. You can't really make a broad general statement like that because we have superb SEALs at all the other teams. But we do get some of the best from all the rest of the teams, and they go to SEAL Team 6. SEAL Team 6, the main operational purpose is maritime counterterrorism. And you will think by the term maritime counterterrorism, they're going to do, you know, raiding ships, visit board search and seizures on ships, maybe oil rigs, maybe the Maersk Alabama, where Captain Phillips was rescued. But SEAL Team 6 and Delta Force, they're sister units. Delta Force has some water capability, but nothing like SEAL Team 6. So it was early on that Delta Force got the land-based missions and SEAL Team 6 got the coastal missions. But now SEAL Team 6 and Delta are all getting the landlocked missions, Afghanistan and Iraq, and it goes back and forth. It really depends on the generals and the lobbies and the politicians, who's getting what operation now.
Since arriving in Afghanistan, the SEALs have operated as a special reconnaissance unit. They were often deployed out in the field for up to 45 days at a time, and they have killed over 200 Taliban fighters and destroyed tens of thousands of pounds of weapons. Key operatives in the War on Terror, SEAL Team 6's most famous mission was assassinating the world's most wanted man, Osama bin Laden. With access to the world's best weapons, best communications, and best aircraft, they are the United States' ultimate soldiers.
The main thing that SEALs have in common is they don't quit. No matter how hard it is, they don't quit. You almost have to have the attitude is, come on, instructors, come on, SEAL instructors, bring it on. Whatever you got, I'll handle. And that's the difference. You also have to have a great sense of patriotism. You have to be willing to put your country and the mission in front of everything.
They made for the perfect partners with the SAS on a rescue mission of this complexity.
SEAL Team 6, the other SEAL teams, and the SAS complement each other in many, many ways. For one, we cross-trained with the SAS for years. They have learned quite a bit from us, and we have learned quite a bit from them. We love working with the SAS. We're the same mindset. We have the same attitude when it comes to training and battle. When we get the opportunity to work with SAS, we jump right on it. And it's a nice collection of mindsets on the force. When you have a platoon or a squad or an assault team and it's mixed with SAS and SEALs, everybody's comfortable.
Now, it was 6 days and counting after the aid workers were abducted. A combined force comprising 28 members of the SAS and an equal number of U.S. Navy SEALs arrived in Badakhshan. They established themselves in a forward operating base around 30 minutes flying time from the hostages' location. The teams are set to go in for a rescue, but they still have all the details to plan out. And even with all their intel, There are some things they couldn't plan for.
5 minutes, that's an awful long time. And then when it's all done, it's all quietened down, the shouting starts, the screams start of the wounded. There's all sorts of nonsense that's going on. Smoke from the flashbang still going around, people screaming, people shouting. But you're all aware of this, and the main thing is find out, have you been shot?
That's next time on Covert. To hear more stories about SEAL Team 6, check out our Covert episodes Killing Bin Laden Parts 1, 2, and 3, as well as Black Hawk Down Parts 1 and 2. And for more stories about the SAS, check out Operation Certain Death Parts 1 and 2, as well as Feuerzauber Parts 1 and 2. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Rights Media co-production hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley, Rachel Jacobs, and Karen Bevan, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had additional production help from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.